50 years ago, on the 11th of November, a political earthquake erupted.
Well, may we say, God save the Queen.
It's the most famous chapter in our political history, and the fallout is still with us today. Hear the whole gripping story of the dismissal, unfolded scene by shocking scene, in our award-winning podcast, The 11th.
He looked at me and said, I owe history nothing.
Search for The 11th on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
All over the world, it's no secret that democracies are suffering a little bit of wheel wobble right now, either slipping into autocratic rule like the United States or into dysfunction like in France. But Australia right now, for the moment, seems remarkably stable in this storm. But on this day, 50 years ago, this country experienced the biggest crisis in our political history. A badly struggling reformist government, mired in scandal, led by the ALP leader Gough Whitlam, was terminated, sacked. Not by the Australian people, but by the Governor-General, Sir John Kerr, the representative of the British monarch in Australia, who immediately appointed the Liberal Party leader Malcolm Fraser as caretaker Prime Minister on the condition that he would call an election. The sacking of the Whitlam government came after the opposition tried to force it to an election by choking off its money supply in the Senate. So intent were they on getting the government to call an election that they were sure they'd win. And after Whitlam was sacked in the Governor-General's office on the morning of November the 11th, 1975, Gough Whitlam went to the lodge, sat down, had lunch, and he waited a full hour before he told anyone else what had happened, and then all hell broke loose. A huge crowd formed on the steps at Parliament House as the proclamation to dissolve Parliament was read out, and then Gough Whitlam took to the microphone and uttered these famous words.
Well, may we say, God save the Queen. Because nothing will save the Governor-General.
The editor-at-large at the Australian newspaper, Paul Kelly, is here today. In 1975, Paul was a young press gallery journo who witnessed these events that shook our democracy to its core. Afterwards, he wrote the definitive account of this ruthless contest for national power called The Unmaking of Gough. Welcome back, Paul.
Very good to be with you, Richard.
You've said this was a crisis between three political giants, and giant killers for that matter. How different do you think were creatures like Gough Whitlam and Malcolm Fraser, for example, compared to today's leaders in Australia?
People looking at today's leaders, Anthony Albanese and Susan Lee, would have no comprehension whatsoever about what Gough Whitlam and Malcolm Fraser were really like. They operated in the shadow of Churchill. World War II wasn't all that far away. They believed that great men changed the course of history. They were conviction politicians, but above all, they were prepared to push the constitutional system to the absolute limits to further their own political self-interest and the principles that they believed in.
Do you think leaders like that are psychologically made up in a very different way to the rest of us?
Completely. There's no doubt. I mean, I spoke to Whitlam and Fraser off the record frequently during the crisis, but I got to know both men very, very well as prime ministers. I covered them both. And there's no doubt that they were consumed with this fundamental belief in the power of prime ministerial authority, in their capacity to change the country, their passion, their beliefs about their own vision, about their own conviction.
What was your experience of Canberra before you entered the press corps? You'd worked in the public service for a brief while, didn't you, Paul?
I worked in the government branch of the Prime Minister's Department, and the government branch serviced Government House. We serviced the Governor-General, we prepared the papers for Executive Council meetings, and I did research papers on the powers of the Governor-General, the convention surrounding the Governor-General, and the relationship between the Governor-General and the Prime Minister. And some of my friends at the time said to me, Paul, why are you doing all this work about this arcane subject about the Governor-General and the Crown's powers? Don't you understand it's all irrelevant? And I often reflected later on when I was covering the 1975 crisis, I often reflected on those discussions. I was very lucky because I had that foundation of knowledge about how the system worked.
The Governor-General then was Sir Paul Hasluck, who was a supremely competent operator and ex-minister himself, and it's often said that this crisis would have gone very differently if he'd been Governor-General. Sir John Kerr was appointed by Gough Whitlam. What kind of a man do you think Sir John Kerr was? How would you describe him?
Kerr was an ambitious man. He was a man absolutely fascinated by politics. Kerr, as a young man, was dedicated to the Labour Party, and his patron, of course, was H.V. Evatt, at that stage the future leader of the Labour Party. But the turning point for Kerr's political development was the Labour Party split in the 1950s, and that was the transition for Kerr from Labour to the Liberal side of politics. Kerr was a lawyer, then he was a judge, but Kerr was approached many times by Liberals to seek pre-selection for the Liberal Party. Kerr had this dream. He had a dream that he might replace Menzies as Liberal Prime Minister. He's written about this in his private papers. He was fascinated by this idea. And many years later, of course, after he became Governor-General and he was staying at Admiralty House, which was his Sydney residence, he reflected on the fact that as a younger man, he dreamt of being at Kirribilli House if, in fact, he had replaced Menzies.
Right, he wanted to live next door to Admiralty House instead. But why didn't he leave the courts like Evatt did and enter the Parliament? What stopped him from doing that?
I'm tempted to quote Gough here. He didn't have the guts. He was fascinated by politics, but the judiciary was safe. Politics exposes the heart. It exposes your life. It is a very, very turbulent and ruthless endeavour. And I think Kerr much preferred to exercise judgment as a judge, with the protection of being a judge. And Kerr said in his private papers, when he accepted Whitlam's offer to become Governor-General, one of the ideas at the back of his head was about the reserve powers, and he thought, well, perhaps there might be an occasion to use the reserve powers. Kerr understood the reserve powers existed. He was fascinated by them. In this sense, Kerr was one of the most inappropriate people Whitlam could have ever appointed as Governor-General. Gough did not do proper due intelligence on Kerr. He was appointing a man who believed in the reserve powers, was interested in their application.
It's like appointing a man who's fascinated with guns, who knows what guns are all about and has the biggest and most powerful loaded gun in the drawer of his desk in Yarralumla.
Exactly.
So you joined the press gallery, working for The Australian, then the Sydney Morning Herald. You're in your mid-20s then. You might have even had long hair and a beard in those days.
Look, I did. I mean, it was the 1970s.
It was.
And one of the things some of us considered in the press gallery, some of the younger people in the press gallery, we thought, how can we look older? How can we generate a sense of wisdom about ourselves? So we grew beards, and in those days I had a black beard and quite long black hair, but unfortunately it started to go grey pretty quickly.
So you went to work in the old Parliament House. What on earth was it like working in that tiny space, famously small space?
It was wonderful.
Yeah.
The point about the old Parliament House was that it was like a large boarding house. It was all about intimacy. We were close to the politicians. I mean, we'd go to the non-members bar of an evening when the Parliament was sitting, and there we are at 7 p.m. and there'd be a group of backbenchers, there'd be a group of ministers, there'd be a group of journalists. We're all having a quick drink to pick up whatever we can before we, the journalists, go back upstairs to write our copy. So we were close to the politicians. We'd hang out in King's Hall. The politicians, the Prime Minister would walk across King's Hall. So there was an opportunity to chat to them, and they'd like to chat to us to see what intelligence we had about what was going on in the building. So there was always this information exchange. There was a lot of intimacy built up between the media and the politicians. That had its good side and it had its bad side.
Whitlam got elected in 1972 after 23 years of the Labor Party being out of power. Did he take an interest in you as a young journalist, or were you beneath his notice in those days? Did he think you were worth cultivating?
Well, he did. I started to get to know Gough well in February 1974. Gough made a 17 or 18 day trip to Southeast Asia, visiting about 7 or 8 countries, and I travelled with him for that 17 days. It was a tremendous experience for me. Gough was interested in the younger journalists who were just assuming influential positions in the press gallery. And on the last day we flew from Manila back to Canberra, Gough came down the back of the plane. There were only 6 or 7 print journalists. He sat down with us and we had a 6-hour briefing with him. And he basically went through with us the entire story of his government to that stage. So dealing with Gough was fantastic. Travelling overseas with Gough was like travelling with the Encyclopedia Britannica, because Gough, as he once said, quite accurately, you could regard me as an expert on history from the time of King David to the present. And essentially he was. So whenever we'd arrive in a particular country, Gough would ensure that in the hour or so before we landed, he'd given us all a briefing about the history of that particular country, whether we're talking about Peru, Jamaica. It was wonderful travelling with him. I had a great time.
I met him a couple of times, Paul, and he had this strange mix of being imperious and really egalitarian. There was a famous story about him, which might have been apocryphal, about, I think it was members of his front bench were arcing up about having to travel economy on a flight. And Whitlam said, "I can travel economy and still be a great man, whereas you lot could travel business class and you'd still be a bunch of pissants." That sort of sums up his imperiousness and egalitarianism at the same time, doesn't it?
It's completely correct. Gough was a classic elitist. I can remember having a discussion with Gough at the end of 1973, after the first year of his government, when there were early signs starting to emerge that the government might be in a bit of trouble. And Gough's attitude then was, "Well, listen, this government's only got one thing going for it, and that's me. If I wasn't here, the Labor Party would be completely stuffed." That was his attitude. And, of course, to a certain extent, there was a degree of truth in that. But it also highlighted something else about Gough. His ego was too big, and it led him into a series of false judgments, particularly during the constitutional crisis.
I think you once said that his delusion was that he thought he could govern Australia on his own terms.
Well, we had a famous story. You'll recollect that after Gough became Prime Minister on the 2nd of December 1972, rather than wait for the election results to be finalised and for the caucus to meet and elect the ministry, Gough said to the Governor-General, Sir Paul Hasluck, "Look, Excellency, I think we need to swear in a 2-person government immediately of myself and my deputy Lance Barnard. We'll occupy all the portfolios." And of course, after the swearing in, one of Gough's standard jokes was, "Well, look, the duumvirate with 2 people was a pretty good government, but I think the only problem was there was 1 minister too many."
In that 2-person government, he brought about instant change on a whole lot of things that had been backed up in the system for a very long while. And this was all done by government fiat within the first week. Was there a trap in this? Do you think that Whitlam might have thought that governing was easy after that?
There was definitely a trap in this. I can remember this so vividly. We in the press were pretty excited, because Gough had a press conference during this period virtually each day, and there were all these really exciting, path-breaking announcements coming out. Later on, I can remember talking to my great friend Graeme Freudenberg, Gough's press secretary and magnificent speechwriter. And Graeme said to me, "You know, I think one of the mistakes of that period was that we left the impression with the Australian public that governing is going to be easy. that it's easy to transform the country, that reform is not really difficult and it's a really exciting thing to do. And all these were profoundly misleading impressions that we'd created. I think there was a lot in that.
The list of achievements of the Whitlam government are very long. You have equal pay for women, like I said, free tertiary education, no-fault divorce laws, a universal health care scheme that was eventually brought out and brought back in by the Hawke government, recognition of China, trade with China, ending conscription, abolition of the death penalty, Indigenous land rights. I mean, there's a very, very long list of extremely substantial achievements. But so was the list of blunders. Do you think the two go hand in hand if you're practicing this crash through or crash style of government as he described it?
They don't have to go hand in hand, but in Gough's case, they did go hand in hand. Gough was a great figure in many ways, but he was also a deeply flawed figure in other ways. Gough had prepared himself so thoroughly for the prime ministership. Gough had this magnificent and long list of reforms, most of which he implemented. But on the other hand, he had a defective understanding of the times. The world was changing. We had the OPEC oil shocks in 1973. We had global stagflation. Gough was dissatisfied with the way Australia was functioning, with the way Australia was governed. But he was inept in terms of economic management, understanding how the world was changing, and it was no longer appropriate to just pump up more and more spending into the system. And he made another fundamental mistake. He was impatient with the Treasury and impatient with Treasury processes, and this led him into the absolute inconceivable and catastrophic blunder of the overseas loan with Tyrath Kemlani. And that loan became fundamental to the integrity arguments against the Whitlam government, unsettling the Governor-General and leading the Governor-General to feel he couldn't trust Whitlam.
These were massive loans that he authorised his Resources Minister, Rex Connor, to undertake, which were going to fund huge pipelines and resources projects right around Australia, which I suppose a lot of environmentalists today would have very strong objections to. Nonetheless, he was going to buy back the farm. That was the idea. But he was going to raise the funds, not through the money markets in New York, but through this currency dealer of uncertain integrity called Tyrath Kemlani. Was there a certain naivety to the government? And is this a sign of what happens when you have a party that's out of power for so long and in the end so alienated from where real power lies in Australia?
A lot of the ministers were really old-fashioned people. They were people straight out of the 1940s, and they were out of touch with contemporary Australia, and in particular, they were out of touch with contemporary realities in relation to economics and finance. Now, that wasn't true of all of them, and in particular, it wasn't true of Bill Hayden. And one of Gough's greatest mistakes, when he sacked Frank Crean as treasurer in late 74, he appointed Cairns, not Hayden, as treasurer. That was a terrible mistake. So when it came to the loan, yes, there was great naivety. There was a sense of, we distrust the normal financial channels. We're going to be smarter. We're going to be cleverer. And of course, they weren't. They were naive in that sense. And later on, years later, I can remember talking to people like Bob Hawke and Paul Keating about this. In private, they were just so damning of the loan, so damning of Whitlam, so damning of Kemlani.
Was it this that really alarmed the Liberals so much? Because I think it was said that only once in the entire 3 years of the Whitlam government did the coalition parties not consider blocking supply against the government. Was it that that alarmed them, or was it more that they never felt there was any legitimacy to a Labor government in this country to begin with?
I think they got alarmed about two things. They got alarmed at the scale of Whitlam's program. There was a sense of panic about that. The other thing that alarmed them was they'd been in government for 23 years. These were the born-to-rule Liberals. This was a completely different Liberal Party to the Liberal Party of today, I can assure you. This was the Liberal Party of the Australian establishment. This was the Liberal Party in 1975 where Malcolm Fraser, a great traditionalist and conservative, was the leader of the opposition, where John Kerr was Governor General with his distaste for the Labor Party, where Sir Garfield Barwick was Chief Justice of the High Court, where the banks and corporate Australia were all very conservative, this was a very different country. It was a very conservative country. And so what Gough was coming up against in his reform agenda, he was coming up against this very, very strong conservative edifice. Australia was their country. They'd run this country through Menzies and through his successors for so long that the prosperity and success of Australia was due to the Liberal Party, and they were totally convinced that the Whitlam government was going to wreck it. Now, this was fundamental to their epic decisions that it was their responsibility to terminate the Whitlam government and force an election by blocking supply. That was the mentality and the psychology which led to those decisions.
Malcolm Fraser became Liberal leader and opposition leader in early 1975 in a party coup. Now, today, when Malcolm Fraser is remembered, he's remembered as this man who was a campaigner for the rights of refugees, a man of the almost to the left of the Labor Party these days. What kind of a man was Malcolm Fraser, though, back in November 1975?
He was tough. He was stoic. He was utterly ruthless. Look at the record. Fraser, on the floor of Parliament, had launched his massive attack on John Gorton as Prime Minister and destroyed Gorton's Prime Ministership. Then a few years later, he launched his campaign against Bill Snedden as Liberal leader and opposition leader to destroy Snedden's leadership and become leader himself, which he achieved in March 1975. And then in October 1975, he blocked the money supply to the Whitlam government, an action which had never occurred previously in Australian history, justifying this by saying the Whitlam government was the worst government in Australian history and had to be removed. And then, during the constitutional crisis, he conspired with the Governor-General to have Gough Whitlam sacked. Just consider that record of ruthless, power-driven politics. I mean, Fraser was a disciplined, conservative and traditionalist. But he was a man imbued with a sense of power, and he was prepared to use power for radical ends if he felt that power had to be deployed to destroy the Whitlam government. So he was this mixture of traditionalist but self-righteousness as well.
So when Rex Connor was caught out misleading Parliament over his attempts yet again to raise funds through these dodgy loans channels, Fraser said that the opposition would block supply in the Senate and force the government to election. Do you think he was confident that Whitlam was going to then call an election, that that would actually work? Was he shocked when Whitlam said no?
No, he wasn't shocked, because Gough had already announced several days beforehand that if the opposition blocked the supply of money in an effort to force him to the electorate, that he would defy the Senate. So Fraser took his decision aware that this was likely to lead to some form of political and constitutional crisis.
A full-blown constitutional crisis. In effect, what you've got is a government that's made in the House of Representatives being held hostage by the Senate, the other chamber of the Parliament. So the House and the Senate are at war with each other. At this point, all eyes should have turned to the Governor-General, who holds the reserve powers to act in these matters. But why was Whitlam so confident that he had Kerr on his side?
He misread Kerr. Gough was really hopeless at personal relations and human understanding. He had great difficulty with a number of senior ministers, and Gough had great difficulty with Kerr. Gough thought he knew Kerr. Gough thought that Kerr was an old-fashioned Labor man who'd been involved with industrial issues when he was a lawyer, that Kerr was the sort of person that he, Gough, could rely upon, and he believed that the Governor-General would simply act on advice from the Prime Minister. He misread Kerr as a man. He misread Kerr as a Governor-General. He treated Kerr, frankly, with almost open contempt. He never confided in Kerr during the constitutional crisis, spoke frankly to him, opened up and talked about what Gough's strategy was for the crisis. Instead of that, he made these public declarations that Kerr, as Governor-General, had no option but to adhere to the advice of the Prime Minister.
Must Sir John Kerr accept your advice, whatever advice you give?
Unquestionably. The Governor-General takes the advice from his Prime Minister and from no one else.
And must act on that advice?
Unquestionably. The Governor-General must act on the advice of his Prime Minister.
There is no tolerance here. He must
do... None whatever.
Did Kerr see that as intimidation?
Kerr was completely convinced Whitlam's trying to intimidate him. Kerr had no doubt at all that all these were pressure tactics by Whitlam, one of the most famous being the dinner for the Malaysian Prime Minister just after the budget was blocked, when Whitlam and Fraser were at the dinner with the Governor-General, and Whitlam joked that it might be a case of whether he sacks me before I can sack him.
It'll be a race to the phone, I think he said. Didn't he say that?
Exactly.
It'll be a race to who can call the palace first.
Exactly. And Kerr didn't think that was funny. Kerr thought that was a very deliberate and considered threat, and he believed he faced another series of threats during the course of the crisis from Whitlam. This is absolutely fundamental to what happened. This is the heart of the crisis. Kerr reaches the conclusion that if he indicates as Governor-General that he's not happy with Whitlam's tactics, Whitlam is likely to move against him, approach the palace, and have him removed as Governor-General. He is paranoid about this. He's focused on this. So he conceals his thinking from Whitlam. Kerr deceives Whitlam for the entire constitutional crisis, for the entire 4.5 weeks. He encourages Whitlam to think that he, Kerr, is on side with Whitlam. But Kerr, because he believes in the reserve powers, is always of the view that if Whitlam fails to get the Senate to crack, then the Governor-General will have to intervene using the reserve powers. He always believed that.
He believes that Whitlam has made this kill or be killed, therefore he's got to act like an assassin.
That's exactly what happened.
As a young Press Gallery journo, you were talking to both Whitlam and Fraser in the lead-up to the dismissal. What were they telling you?
Both of them were totally convinced that they would prevail, and both of them were totally convinced that they understood the nature of the Governor-General. I'd talk to Gough, and Gough would say to me, in his intimidating but characteristic way, "Comrade, I've never been more certain than anything else in my life that Kerr will do the right thing. Kerr understands the issue. We can count on Kerr." Then I'm talking to Malcolm Fraser, and on the evening of Thursday, the 6th of November, I saw Fraser in the opposition leader's office about 6:15 for a 15-minute off-the-record discussion about the crisis. This was just after Fraser had had his last meeting with Kerr that afternoon. So I said to Fraser, off the record, "How do you think this is going to be resolved? We've gone on now for nearly a month." And he was very confident, very calm. He just said to me, "The Governor-General will intervene to resolve the crisis unless Whitlam recommends an election." And I said to him, "How will he intervene?" And Fraser said to me, "He will intervene by dismissing the Prime Minister." Very calm, very measured, very convinced. And of course, he proved to be completely accurate.
This is 5 days before the dismissal.
This is 5 days before the dismissal. So you can understand the conundrum I'm in. I'm talking to both the leaders off the record, and they are both generating this enormous sense of complete confidence in the Governor-General. So I've got to admit, I was puzzled. I did not know how this issue was going to be resolved.
What does that suggest to you? I mean, it can mean a lot of different things, but it does seem to imply that Fraser at that point had entered into a conspiracy, is that the word, with the Governor-General? Or do you think Fraser might have been bluffing?
I know now what happened that afternoon when Fraser saw Kerr, because 20 years later, Fraser told me when I wrote my book at the 20th anniversary of the dismissal, and then Kerr subsequently revealed it as well. What happened in that last meeting was, this is the 6th of November, 5 days before the 11th, Fraser threatens Kerr. Fraser says to Kerr, "Governor-General, this deadlock has gone on. If you do not intervene to resolve the deadlock, we, the opposition, are going to have to make a public statement that you have dishonoured your obligations as Governor-General, that you have let down the country." Okay? That's what Fraser says. This is a threat. There's no question this is a threat. Fraser basically said to him, if you don't intervene, you will imperil forever the reserve powers of the Crown. So essentially, that's what happens that afternoon. And I think Fraser leaves that meeting with Kerr feeling pretty confident because he's put it on the line. He knows Kerr understands the reserve powers, and he's made it clear to Kerr, if you don't intervene and do something, then you're going to be in big trouble because we will publicly hold you to account.
So Whitlam's being interviewed by Richard Carlton, and Whitlam says, unquestionably, Sir John Kerr, the Governor-General, must follow my advice. But Fraser, in private, is saying, if you don't intervene, then we're going to call this out in the federal parliament. Fraser was the better judge of Kerr than Whitlam then.
This is the critical issue. It goes to two things: the character of the Governor-General and the powers of the office. Now, there's no doubt at all that Fraser outfoxed Whitlam in terms of judgment about Kerr. I mean, Fraser wasn't a foreigner to Kerr. Fraser had had dealings with Kerr many, many years earlier on. Fraser, all the way through the crisis, was operating on the assumption that provided the Senate would hold and Whitlam did not advise an election, then Kerr would act. That this is the responsibility of the Governor-General given the powers in the office. So they were the two judgments Fraser made, Kerr's character and his view of the powers. Whitlam made similar judgments on both fronts and got them both wrong. Whitlam believed Kerr was on his side, totally wrong. And secondly, Whitlam believed that Kerr would never use the powers. Now, there's another phenomenal story. What happens on the afternoon of Thursday, the 6th of November? Hayden, as Treasurer, goes to Government House to brief the Governor-General at Kerr's request on the alternative financial arrangements. And Kerr starts talking about Whitlam's magnificent fighting abilities and the fact that Whitlam, even when he's got his back to the wall, can still win an election. Hayden thinks, what is this about?
Oh, wait a minute. Yeah.
Hayden leaves Yarralumla. He's supposed to go to Canberra Airport to fly to Brisbane. He doesn't. He goes straight back to Parliament House. He gets Whitlam out of a meeting. He says to Whitlam, and Whitlam's standing up there, fiddling with his glasses, looking down his nose at Hayden, and Hayden says, Gough, I've just been with Kerr. All my instincts as a Queensland copper tell me he's thinking of sacking us. And Gough looks down and says, no, comrade, he wouldn't have the guts for that.
So November 11 rolls around. Whitlam is due to go and visit the Governor-General that morning to request a half-Senate election, which he hopes, but not very realistically, that will resolve the deadlock. Where were you that morning, Paul? What do you remember of that day?
I remember the whole day vividly. It was 50 years ago, but I can remember what I did and I can remember how I felt. I got to Parliament House at 8:30 in the morning. It was a lovely spring day. I was on the lookout for Gough because I knew Gough was the agent of action, because I knew Gough was going to be chasing the half-Senate election that day. Then I started prowling around the building. There was a 9 a.m. meeting between Whitlam and Fraser to see if there could be a compromise. I knew there'd be no compromise. And from that time on, things start to flow. The Labor caucus meets and Whitlam briefs the Labor caucus that he's going to request a half-Senate election that day. I'm in King's Hall when the Labor caucus breaks and the MPs and ministers come flooding across King's Hall. They're laughing, they're joking, they're euphoric. They think they're going to win the crisis. They think that Whitlam's decision to go to Yarralumla and seek a half-Senate election is going to be the transforming initiative that they need. I don't believe this for a minute, but that is the euphoria. On the opposition side, it's quiet. It's very quiet. The opposition parties meet, and Fraser and Phil Lynch, his deputy, don't brief them about the crisis and don't tell them that Whitlam is about to seek a half-Senate election. And when the opposition parties break and we find out that they haven't been told that Whitlam's seeking a half-Senate election, the media starts saying Fraser was too frightened to tell them. So upstairs in the press gallery that morning, about 11 or 11:30, Mungo McCallum is walking the length and breadth of the press gallery with his infectious laugh, telling us Fraser's finished. Fraser won't even survive as leader, that Whitlam is on the verge of his greatest ever victory. So this was the sort of sense in the press gallery and sense in the government benches. I didn't share it at all. I knew enough about the way the Governor-General functions. I was very confident Kerr couldn't give Whitlam the half-Senate election because supply would expire, so he couldn't do it. I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't foresee dismissal, but I did not share the euphoria of the Labor benches that day or most of the press gallery.
Now we know what happened that morning was that Whitlam arrived at Yarralumla with the advice for half-Senate election. But before he could do so, Kerr said, before we get onto that, I'm giving you this letter which terminates your commission as Prime Minister. Whitlam walks out in a state of shell shock, goes back to the lodge, has lunch, doesn't tell anyone for a whole hour. And when they all pile in, he says, the bastard sacked us. Doesn't even bother to tell his Senate leader at that point. What's your impression of that, Paul?
It's the greatest shock of his life. It's a humiliation. He's been sacked. He's no longer the Prime Minister. He leaves Government House with his Prime Ministerial Commission withdrawn. His great mistake was not to have a contingency plan. I mean, I will never forgive Gough such incompetence. This crisis had gone on for more than 4 weeks. There was discussion about the possibility of dismissal. He got a lot of advice about the need for a contingency plan. He didn't have one. So he goes back to the lodge. He has lunch. Then he calls the colleagues around. He does not call the Senate leader, Ken Reed. He does not call the Senate leader. Well, okay, Gough doesn't know. Then Fraser is already commissioned. Fraser has a caretaker commission from Kerr subject to certain conditions. And those main conditions are that Fraser, as Prime Minister, will now obtain supply which had been blocked to the Whitlam government for the previous 4 weeks. Now Fraser is Prime Minister. He needs to have supply, and that he will recommend a double dissolution election to the Governor-General so the country goes straight to an election. Okay, so Fraser has a caretaker commission subject to those conditions. Now, the only way Gough can undermine the Kerr-Fraser compact here is in the Senate. If he can delay giving supply to the Fraser government, then he can create a lot of trouble for them. Gough doesn't think about this. He doesn't think about the Senate. What he does instead, and it's sort of understandable in one sense, he drafts a motion of no confidence in the new Fraser government because Gough still has the numbers in the House of Representatives. Well, okay, that's important, but the idea that Kerr is going to change his mind, turn around, sack Fraser and recommission Gough as Prime Minister is, of course, utterly improbable and fantastic. It's not going to happen. And so Gough takes his mind off the Senate, where he can actually achieve something, and his focus is on the House, where at the end of the day he can have a symbolic win that's meaningless.
In this very moment, when blocking the budget again by the Labor Party in the Senate becomes an option, I get this feeling of this is a moment when our democracy could have cracked. This is when our democracy had reached a point of enormous danger.
I want to answer that in two ways. There's something I should have said that I haven't said earlier. This was a Kerr-Fraser conspiracy, in my view. And the reason I say this is because we now know about the phone call Kerr made to Fraser at 9:55 a.m. that morning when Kerr asked Fraser if he was commissioned as a caretaker Prime Minister, would he accept a series of conditions? And those conditions involved recommending a double dissolution election and obtaining supply. Okay? Kerr knew if he commissioned Fraser as Prime Minister at lunchtime, he had to be totally confident that Fraser would adhere to the Kerr plan. And so Kerr tipped off Fraser in the morning about what he was planning to do. And when I spoke to Malcolm about this 20 years later, Malcolm confirmed to me that that's actually what Kerr did. Okay, now what this means, of course, is Fraser's got to get supply. Now, there's no guarantee Fraser can actually get supply.
No, and he's not in a position to say he can to Kerr either, is he?
Exactly, but he has said he will get supply. Fraser calls in the archdemon and Senate manipulator the leader of the Liberal Party in the Senate, the jovial Reg Withers, and says, Reg, I want you to get supply. And Withers says, leave it with me. So the Senate resumes at 2 o'clock. Withers is sitting there smiling, knowing that Fraser is now the Prime Minister. Ken Reet, the Labor leader, does not know Whitlam's been sacked. He doesn't know. I know it's unbelievable, but he didn't know, and the senior Labor senators didn't know. They find out about 2:10. Supply is passed at 2:24, and the Senate adjourns at 2:35. Okay, now, if there'd been a contingency plan, it was probably possible for the Labor Party, having been sacked, to delay the passage of supply through various means. But, of course, they didn't have time to think that through because they didn't know they'd actually been sacked. So things could have gone badly wrong. But there's another really important point to make about this, which goes to Gough's frailties and total incompetence at the time. Whitlam was advised, in order to protect himself, that he should put an addendum to the supply bills. And the supply bills, after they were approved by the Senate, had to go back to the House a second time for approval. Now, this was recommended to Whitlam by the Prime Minister's department. And what it actually meant was that if Fraser became Prime Minister and obtained supply, Fraser, as a minority Prime Minister, would have to go back to the House and get the House to vote a second time on the supply bills, and they wouldn't do it because he didn't have the majority in the House. If Whitlam accepted this contingency provision, then there would have been an even more profound crisis that afternoon because Fraser could not have met the conditions of his caretaker commission.
So Fraser is appointed caretaker Prime Minister. There's this extraordinary scenes in the House of Representatives when Fraser announces that to the House.
Mr. Speaker, this afternoon, the Governor-General commissioned me to form a government until elections can be held.
I'd suggest that honourable members on my right remain silent. They want to stay in the House.
Then after that, David Smith, the Governor-General's secretary, goes out and stands on the front steps of Parliament House. You can hardly hear a word he's saying as he's reading out the proclamation dissolving Parliament in a general election. Whitlam's standing behind him. And he steps forward and makes that extraordinary, well, may we say God save the Queen, speech.
I'm standing very close to Gough, 3 or 4 steps down from where he is. He is consumed by adrenaline. He's in another zone of human experience. His head is in the air. Gough is a magnificent stage performer. He was a born actor. He knows this is an adrenaline-charged historical moment. And so he stands up for democracy and he denounces Kerr and Fraser.
The proclamation which you have just heard read by the Governor-General's official secretary was countersigned Malcolm Fraser. Who will undoubtedly go down in Australian history from Remembrance Day 1975 as Kerr's Kerr.
I've called this magnificence in martyrdom. But the trouble is, Whitlam's defeated. Whitlam has been outmanoeuvred by Kerr and Fraser, and there's nothing he can do about it. All he can do now is appeal to the people.
You can hear the crowd in the background. They're really angry. You were there. Was there a sense of incipient violence in the air?
Richard, this is a really critical point. Now, I was there when Fraser had gone down the front stairs a couple of hours earlier to go to Government House, and I was there when Gough made his speech. Okay, the crowd is there. It's building up. It's a very large crowd, and it's angry. It's really angry. It feels... democracy is under threat in Australia. That's the feeling. However, there's no violence. There is no violence. When Fraser comes down the stairs and gets in the car to go out to Government House to recommend the election, people are angry. They are abusing him. They don't bash the car. No one attacks Fraser physically. Now, this is quite important because remember what happens at Yarralumla when Gough is sacked. Gough accepts the dismissal. Gough doesn't tear up the letter. Gough doesn't say to Kerr, I don't accept the reserve powers. Gough doesn't say, I'm going to have you arrested as Governor General. Gough doesn't do any of those things. Gough is a constitutionalist, and in his moment of absolute humiliation, he accepts the dismissal, and he always accepts the dismissal. So when he's on the front stairs, Gough is not inciting mob violence. What he's doing is he's attacking Kerr and Fraser, and he's starting his campaign to appeal to the Australian people to vote for Labor in the cause of democracy. That's what he's doing as a constitutionalist. But in no way is he a populist inciting violence. I think in the year we live in now, 2025, it's really important to understand this feature of the 11th of November. It was an outrage, as far as I'm concerned. It was an abuse by the Governor-General of the Crown's powers. But Whitlam, the dismissed Prime Minister, accepted what happened and went to the election.
Men and women of Australia, the whole future of Australian democracy is in your hands.
The crowds were enormous. The crowds were just fantastic in Labor's campaign. But there were two Australians. There were the true believers who went out to support Gough Whitlam during the campaign, and there was the rest of the country which had decided, yep, we've got an election, we're going to vote out this government. There's a story I've got to tell. So it's a couple of days after the dismissal, so the campaign started. So we go to Sydney with Gough. We fly down in the plane, and we get in the press bus at Sydney Airport, and we drive into the city, and we get to Surry Hills, and I'm sitting in the press bus, I'm looking out the window, and I see all these little kids, these primary school kids, in their school uniform, lining up and marching to Prince Alfred Pool. And I suddenly think, having been consumed by the constitutional crisis, and I think, hang on, this is Australia in summer. The shops are open, the traffic's busy, and the kids are going to the swimming pool, and for most of the country, it's just a normal day. And I realise Gough's got no hope in this election campaign.
He was defeated by, I think, the biggest landslide in Australian history or since the 1930s. Anyway.
He was. Fraser had a 55-seat majority, the biggest in Australian history.
Afterwards, there were claims that the CIA had somehow instigated the dismissal. Whitlam had been on President Nixon's enemies list. There was talk allegedly at Pine Gap about our man Kerr in Yarralumla. Afterwards, President Carter's envoy went to Whitlam, who was the then opposition leader, and told him that the US would never again interfere in Australian politics. What do you make of this?
Richard, I've looked at this on and off for nearly 50 years, and in particular, I looked at it in great detail in 1976 when I wrote my book, The Unmaking of Gough. I can assure you the CIA was not involved in the dismissal of the Whitlam government. The dismissal of the Whitlam government was all based on Australia's political and constitutional realities at the time. It was all based on the constitutional decisions made by Sir John Kerr. I've spoken to the most senior security officials involved in Australia at this time, who gave me off-the-record details of their assessment and their knowledge, and I am 100% satisfied that this had nothing to do with the CIA.
Does the Paul Kelly of 2025 see the dismissal, the events of that extraordinary season, differently from the Paul Kelly that was then reporting on these events back in 1975?
I have not changed my fundamental view of 1975. I believe that 1975 was a completely improper exercise of the reserve powers of the Crown, which do exist, and that the Governor-General was guilty of a grievous and inexcusable and improper exercise of those powers, which amounted to a constitutional ambush of the Prime Minister and a deception of the Prime Minister. I believe that Whitlam was guilty of massive incompetence throughout the crisis in terms of the misjudgments he made, in terms of his confidence, in terms of his arrogance. I believe that Fraser's management of this crisis displayed skills and nerve of an extremely high order. While I'm a critic of what Fraser did, as a professional political observer, I can recognise the enormous judgment and skill that Fraser exercised in bringing this crisis to a successful completion for himself and achieving a great electoral success.
No constitutional system can ever be perfect. Ours has its interesting features, as you say, the reserve powers that sit in place, the fact that it's very, very hard to change our constitution. Nonetheless, you're aware, as I am, as a great many people are, of the great democratic recession that's happening worldwide. Do you fear for Australia, Australia's democracy?
I'm concerned about democracy worldwide. I think a lot of the Western democracies are fractured internally. They're losing their way. And consensus about fundamental issues is disintegrating. All one's got to do is look at the two great democracies that influenced us so much, the United Kingdom and the United States, to recognise that there are really fundamental problems in the democratic system. And also, of course, we've got the rise of very, very powerful autocrats in the world, which are having a profound impact. When it comes to Australia, we don't have the depth of these problems to the same extent as other countries. And I think that's a good thing. Now, I'm not saying that we don't have problems in this country. I am concerned about the democratic fabric in Australia. But I guess I'm more concerned about the economic, cultural and social fragmentation of the country. Because I think you can only have a successful democracy if you have a successful society. You've got to have a society which can come to grips with change, which can accept one party being in government, losing an election, and another party coming into government. And that's what we're good at, and that's very important. But nonetheless, we do have a governing problem in this country, in the sense that we are no longer performing with first best policy at all. At the national level, I think going back to really the end of the Howard period, we can see, looking at the Rudd-Gillard period, and then the most recent period of coalition government under Abbott, Turnbull and Morrison, you're starting to see a decline in the quality of public policy. And what this means is the electorate gets restless. It gets upset, it gets impatient, it starts to get angry, and you get more support from the polarities, more support from, if you like, the far right and the far left, and the centre starts to look weaker. So I think we have this problem. It's not as severe as other countries, but we shouldn't take for granted the problems we have. They are real and they need to be addressed.
As always, fascinating and enlightening speaking with you, Paul, and thank you very much.
Thanks, Richard.
Podcast and broadcast. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler.
Today's conversation with Paul Kelly was made in the lands of the Gadigal people. Producer is Alice Moldovan. Executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.